Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for September 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. In this podcast, I speak with Krista Schwartz of Jones Day in Chicago regarding the right and the wrong time to look at the originality of part of a copyrighted work. I also speak with Charles Weiss of Kenyon & Kenyon in New York City regarding the Ariad case and the Federal Circuit's decision to reconsider the written description requirement under U.S. patent law. Copyright generally protects the specific expression of an idea. There is, however, an exclusion from copyright protection when a work has to incorporate certain things. A Western movie, for example, has to have a shootout. A detective movie has to have something that someone has that everyone else wants. These components of a copyrighted work that just have to be there are called, in the context of copyright law, sens affaire. Under this doctrine, such parts that are standard, stock, or common are not to be protected by copyright. In the context of computer software, the sens affaire doctrine excludes from copyright protection those components of a software program that have to be present to ensure design standards, compatibility, or that embody standard computer programming practices. Krista Schwartz is a partner in the Chicago office of Jones Day, who specializes in computer and electronic-related litigation. She's a recommended lawyer for patent litigation in the Legal 500 U.S. Directory. Krista recently co-authored a paper, published in Copyright World, pointing out that the court doesn't always apply the sens affaire doctrine properly, and she proposed a general formula for future application.
Hello, Krista.
Hello, Don.
You've entitled your article Software and Sens Affaire, a Modest Proposal for Application of the Doctrine in Computer Software Cases. What is your modest proposal for the court to properly apply the sens affaire doctrine?
Well, I was recently involved in a case involving computer software copyright issues. And in that case, one of the defenses that was raised was a sens affaire defense. And essentially, the defendants were trying to argue that portions or elements of the software should not be protectable with copyright because they were standard, stock, or common, and therefore were sens affaire. And in looking at the case law, we saw that this is an argument that has come up in the past and comes up frequently in the computer software context, where the plaintiff is looking to protect certain elements of the software. And the defendants argue that, well, those different elements, we can find those in a variety of different systems that are on the market today, that therefore they're standard items and they're not subject to copyright protection because of sens affaire. So in that kind of context, the question that really came to mind for us is, what is the right time frame to use when you're trying to determine and evaluate whether various software features are standard or sends a fair element and therefore not protectable? And it seems like it boils down to two different time frames. One would be, do you look at this at the time of authorship, the time the software was written, or do you look at it rather at the time of litigation? So do you look to see what other systems are on the market while the case is being litigated to see whether or not those elements have become standard, or are you really looking back to see whether the elements were standard when the software was written? And the real problem in the case law that we ran into is that most courts don't explicitly address the time frame question at all. Courts will evaluate sens affaire in computer software, and some courts have wound up evaluating whether elements are standard at the time of authorship. Some have wound up evaluating whether they were standard at the time of litigation. Other courts have blended the two and looked at systems that were there before and after. And in almost all cases, the courts don't address the timing issue. You kind of have to piece the decisions apart to try and figure out what time they're really looking for. So our modest proposal with that background is that we believe that the correct time to evaluate a sens affaire defense is at the time of authorship, and that our modest proposal would be to clarify the case law and make clear that the time that you should look at for evaluating sens affaire is the time of the authorship of the software and what elements were standard at that time. And if they were standard, then they should not be protectable under the Sens Affaire defense.
In one of the cases you discuss in your article, the Apple and Microsoft case, you say the court got their time frames wrong. What happened in that case?
Well, in the Apple-Microsoft case, Apple sued Microsoft and HP for copyright infringement. And essentially, Apple was claiming that about 150 different elements from the Macintosh graphical user interface had been appropriated by Microsoft and HP. And with that context, the case primarily focused on Microsoft defenses rather than HP's. And one of the major issues in that case is whether or not various elements were standard under the Sens Affaire doctrine. The court at the district court level received a videotape from Microsoft with some 25 to 30 different systems showing different graphical user interfaces that were available both before the Apple Macintosh and after. Majority of the graphical user interfaces on that tape came after the Macintosh was released. So they were not systems that were around at the time the Macintosh interface was offered. They were rather around at the time of litigation. And one interesting thing was that the court noted that the Macintosh was one of the major commercial triumphs of the 1980s, and that was largely due to the fact that the Macintosh graphical interface was such a different and the first system to be commercially successful to take the different graphical elements together and make them available on the consumer market. So the court seemed to recognize that the Macintosh had done something unique and really been able to take some ideas and some concepts and some elements and be the first to put them in a commercially successful product. But from that launching off point, the court then went through all the different systems on the videotape that Microsoft provided. Again, most of these were available after the Macintosh was out, and said, well, this element that Apple wants to protect was in this system. Yeah, this other element was in these four or five systems. And because all these different elements I can find in various systems that are available, these elements I'm going to decide are standard and therefore are not protectable under the Sens Affaire doctrine. So the court was looking at a few systems that were available before, which would have been time of authorship, but most of them were after at the time of litigation. So the court, again, didn't set out any type of time frame to evaluate Sens Affaire and wound up looking at systems across the map from the time of authorship through the time of litigation, and actually wound up finding that certain things that were standard at the time of litigation, because they had become more popular and more widely used, meant that Apple could not protect those with copyright because they had become standard or Sens Affaire art elements. So based on the 26 to 30 systems that existed, the court found Apple evidence that the different elements in the Apple interface were standard treatment in the industry and therefore not protectable. So the court almost seems to be saying that because the Macintosh had become so popular and successful, it had become its own standard. Other people had followed it. Those elements were now standard in the industry, and in some sense, Apple became a victim of its own success and lost the ability to copyright its items because they had become so successful and popular.
The Apple and Microsoft case took place some time ago. Was it back in 1992?
That is correct. It was decided in late in 1992.
In your paper, you refer to a more recent case, the Integrated Barcoding System case, a district court decision from 2007, but it seemed to have suffered the same problems that the Apple and Microsoft case did. Could you explain the Integrated Barcoding Systems case?
Well, the Integrated Barcoding case is a little bit of a different set of facts in that there was a developer who worked for Integrated Barcoding and had helped Integrated Barcoding develop what they called their QuickTrack data collection software. And after a period of time, the developer and Integrated Barcoding parted ways, and the developer went and joined a different company, Integrated Data Solutions. And he was hired explicitly to create a competing data collection software program. So from the beginning, the goal of the software that was accused of infringement was to compete and be close to the integrated barcoding QuickTrack data collection software, almost a situation where it's someone trying to clone the software. So Integrated Barcoding sued the developer, Wemert, and his employer, Integrated Data Solutions, claiming that the Integrated Data Solutions competing software that was developed infringed on the copyrights for Integrated Barcoding's QuickTrack software and its source code. And again, in this case, the Send the Fair defense was raised, and the defendants were claiming that all of the similarities that existed between Integrated Barcoding's source code and a competing Integrated Data Solutions source code were common programming items that were standard in the industry. You could find them in other products that were available on the web and the internet, and therefore they shouldn't be protected. And once again, the court in Integrated Barcoding didn't restrict itself to looking solely at whether aspects of the software source code that the plaintiffs were trying to protect were widely used in industry at the time of authorship as opposed to the time of litigation. And so the court did wind up, again, looking at some systems that were available before Integrated Barcoding's product, but also looked at many that didn't exist until after the Integrated Barcoding product was released and really didn't exist until the time of litigation. And so the court, once again, doesn't address or acknowledge the timing issue in terms of what time frame it should be looking at Send the Fair. And unfortunately, it wound up looking at a number of systems that didn't exist at the time that the Integrated Barcoding software was authored. So those items were not standard at the time of authorship, and whether they may or may not have been at the time of litigation, it doesn't seem to us like that's the right question. So unfortunately, by not addressing the time frame issue, it looks like the court looked at systems that it probably should not have in doing its Sons of Fair analysis.
You refer to a few cases that have applied the doctrine properly but have not articulated a general rule. One is Mitel against IQTEL. What did the court hold in that case?
Well, Mitel was looking to protect what are called command codes that were used in its call controller software. So a series of different numbers, essentially, that were the interface for the software and allowed the installers to set up the software in the right way. And because the call center software was so incredibly successful, IQTEL decided that the best way to compete was to use the exact same command codes that Mitel used. So again, there was a conscious decision that there's a successful product out there. We want to be able to compete. The best way for us to compete is to use the exact same elements. So Mitel sued IQTEL, claiming copyright infringement on those command code user interface elements. And the district court level, the district court found that the command codes were not protectable copyrightable subject matter. And it found they were not protectable because of the Send the Fair doctrine. Basically, the district court found two separate reasons why the command codes were subject to the Send the Fair doctrine. One is because of different constraints that existed when Mitel wrote the software. For example, to be compatible with some of the equipment that the software worked with, there were certain codes that constrained or limited their choices. And those are certainly constraints that would have existed at the time of authorship. But the district court also then went on and said that because of market forces and efficiency considerations, essentially saying that at the time of litigation it's a very successful product, and if you want to compete, that also means these are standard. And so the district court looked at things that were available both at the time of authorship and the time of litigation. And on appeal, the Tenth Circuit correctly upheld a portion of the district court's decision. It looked at the constraints that existed at the time of authorship, in other words, the different codes that had to be selected because of compatibility concerns or because there were a limited number of choices, that those meant that at the time of authorship, Send the Fair limited the choices, and therefore they weren't protectable. But the Tenth Circuit went further and said that the district court absolutely should not have looked at market forces and efficiency considerations that existed at the time of litigation. And although the Mitel decision does not use the actual terms time of authorship, time of litigation, that's essentially the rationale of the court. That, you know, the portion of the district court items that they looked at that were around when the software was authored that constrained what the author could do with the software, those different items should properly restrict what is protectable by copyright under Senza Fair. But whether or not something is popular in the market at the time of litigation is irrelevant. You can't have a product be a victim of its own success, and that the more popular it becomes, the weaker its copyrights are. So to that extent, we think the Tenth Circuit really did the analysis the right way, even though they didn't break it down explicitly in terms of talking about time of authorship and time of litigation.
In your article, you analogize your proposed formula for copyright law to patent law, where inventiveness is determined at the time of the invention. What parallels do you see between the basis for copyright protection and inventions in patent law?
What's interesting, in patent law, the purpose of a patent is to reward invention and protect novel and original ideas that people come up with. And when you look at what the purpose of copyright law is, the purpose of copyright seems to be roughly parallel, and it's really to reward creative and original expression. Both are designed to encourage people to be creative, to come up, in the case of patents, with new ideas. In the case of copyrights, with new expressions, something unique and new, and to add to the knowledge that's out in the universe. And so both of them are trying to reward people coming up with original items. And I think patent law, when we look at the question of invalidity, recognizes that because the purpose is to come up with something new and novel, when you're looking at an invalidity analysis, for in the case of obviousness, the question is not whether the invention is obvious now, but it's whether it was obvious at the time of the invention. And so if you analogize then to the copyright context, where you have the same similar types of purpose, where you want to reward people to be creative and original and come up with something new, then the question of whether something in the copyright context is original or whether elements were stock or standard or sans affaire should really be evaluated at the time of authorship, just like obviousness in the patent case is evaluated at the time of invention, because you're really trying to look at whether someone came up with something that was original, creative, expressive, and the only way to figure out whether they came up with something original and creative is at the time they actually authored it. Once it's out in the world, if people are feed on those ideas, and it may crop up in other works, but that doesn't take away the fact that it may have been original and expressive at the time it was actually authored.
Thank you very much for these insights, Krista.
Oh, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Don.
The opening language of the U.S. Patent Act, 35 U.S.C. 112, is pretty straightforward. It says, "The specification shall contain a written description of the invention and of the manner and process of making and using it in such full, clear, concise, and exact terms as to enable any person skilled in the art to which it pertains to make and use the same." The U.S. courts have recognized that a patent must tell the skilled reader how to make and use the invention. That, after all, is the quid pro quo for the limited monopoly, so that when the patent expires, the skilled reader will be able to make and use the invention. What is less clear is the extent of any further obligation to provide a written description of the invention, particularly in the area of biotechnology inventions. In 2004, in a case between the University of Rochester and Searle, the claims claimed an invention purely by its functional characteristics. A method of selectively inhibiting a first compound having a particular functionality by administering a non-steroidal compound that selectively inhibited the activity of that first compound. The disclosure did not disclose a specific compound, nor did it provide a suggestion as to how it could be made, nor was there a pre-existing awareness in the art of a compound that exhibited the claimed activity. The Federal Circuit held that the patent was invalid for failing to provide a written description of the invention. More recently, in April 2009, The Federal Circuit followed the University of Rochester case in Ariad Pharmaceuticals against Eli Lilly and Company and held the claims at issue to be invalid because the patent did not provide a written description of the invention. The Ariad patent related to a method for reducing the level of expression of genes that are activated by extracellular influences that induced intracellular signaling that is mediated by a particular compound. The invention was to reduce the activity of that particular compound. In other words, control the output of the factory by reducing the activity of the particular compound that controlled the output. The claims did not specify what compound was to be used to reduce the activity of the particular compound. The Federal Circuit recently granted a petition to rehear the Ariad appeal before the full court. It has asked counsel to submit briefs on two questions. Question 1, does 35 U.S.C. 112 paragraph 1 contain a written description requirement separate from the enablement requirement? Question 2, if yes, what is the scope and purpose of the requirement? The arguments are likely to be heard in early 2010. Charles Weiss is a partner with the Kenyon & Kenyon firm in New York City. His practice concentrates on technology-driven litigation, counseling, and transactions, and he primarily works in the pharmaceutical, chemical, and biotechnology areas. He is also an adjunct professor teaching patent litigation and analysis at New York Law School. I spoke with Mr. Weiss from his office in New York City. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Don.
The Federal Circuit has decided to rehear the appeal in the Ariad case. What's the significance of this?
The Federal Circuit does not hear en banc, meaning the full court, that many appeals each year. And the issue that is being posed for decision in the Ariad case is one that has created some division and disagreement among the Federal Circuit judges over the last decade or so. And so the decision to rehear the appeal in the Ariad case is an indication that there are probably a majority of judges on the court who either believe that the existing precedent needs to be changed and that it is not correct, or that there is a majority of judges who do not necessarily believe that it's incorrect, but who believe that it's gotten to a point where the uncertainty over the precedent is such that the court needs to make a definitive statement about what the law is in this area.
The questions posed by the court, the first question, does USC 35 U.S.C. 112, paragraph 1, contain a written description requirement, seems pretty straightforward to me. The language itself seems that it does. It looks like question 2 is the real one. What is the scope and purpose of the requirement? What avenues do you see the court looking into in terms of determining what is the scope and purpose of the written description requirement?
Sure. The relatively conventional application of the written description requirement that has not been really controversial over the years is what I might call a procedural one. And it is used, for example, to police priority or to determine if an application that is amended as prosecution goes on had a permissible amendment or an amendment that added new matter and broadened the scope of the application. So the conventional application of written description is sort of like, is the fit between the disclosure and the claims correct, or is an applicant trying to overreach by broadening his or her claims down the road, typically with an eye on what the competitors are doing, and is trying to claim something that was never part of the invention to begin with. So that is what I'm calling, for lack of a better terminology, the procedural aspect of written description that I do not think is controversial. What's at issue in this case and what the Federal Circuit will be looking at en banc is whether there is a substantive limitation on the scope of the claims that is imposed by the written description requirement. Traditionally, in U.S. patent law, problems of overbreath have been dealt with either by anticipation or obviousness on the one hand, because if a claim is reading on the prior art or obvious in light of the prior art because it's so broad, then obviously it's unpatentable or invalid, and by the enablement requirement, which is that the specification must have sufficient disclosure to enable a person of ordinary skill in the art to practice the full scope of the claim without undue experimentation. And that full scope is the important part of the enablement requirement in most cases in terms of claim breadth. That if a claim is significantly broader than the teachings of the specification, then even if the specification gives information about one way to practice a method, if the claim tries to embrace all methods that achieve that result, then one would ordinarily say there was not full scope enablement and the claim would be struck down. What the court is looking at now in the Ariad case, and what has been somewhat controversial in the past, is whether written description serves a similar purpose to enablement in terms of policing claim scope. And if a claim that is written broadly to capture, for example, all methods of regulating a biological pathway, or that captures the regulation of a biological pathway without regard to what compound or even family of compounds is given to the person to do that, can be held invalid or unpatentable pretty much on their face as a matter of law without complicated factual analysis of what a person of ordinary skill in the art would or would not be able to do and what quantity of experimentation is necessary, which are all part of the enablement requirement, whether that can all be shortcut, and whether either the district court or, in this case, the Court of Appeals essentially can look at the matter de novo, overrule the jury, and say the testimony doesn't really matter. When we look at the claim and we look at the specification, the claim is too broad, and therefore it is invalid for lack of written description. It's that kind of limitation on the claim scope that has been controversial and that the court looks like it will be addressing in the Ariad case.
The claims in the Ariad case and those in the University of Rochester case seem somewhat circular. It's as if the claim claims a method for curing baldness by claiming a method of inhibiting all compounds that cause baldness. Are we talking about here a problem in claiming in functional language as opposed to claiming in molecular language by describing the particular compound?
I think that's part of it, and that's been a frequent pattern that can be seen in these cases. But I think, pardon the pun, that that's both too broad and too narrow. It's too broad in the sense that if you consider one of the earliest cases in this line, which is Regents of the University of California versus Eli Lilly, where the issue was claims to DNA encoding insulin, for example, human insulin. Structure of DNA in general as a chemical matter, of course, is known. And if the amino acid sequence of human insulin is known, then it's not that difficult. In fact, a high school advanced biology student should be able to just look in a chart and write down the DNA sequence that would code for human insulin. So yet claims like that were held invalid for lack of written description. I think that perhaps illustrates the difficulty of trying to answer, really, the question of whether something is structural or functional. In your example about a claim for curing baldness comprising administration of a drug that cures baldness, it's easy to answer it. And that would be, you know, perhaps purely functional because there's nothing that says anything about the compound. But if you look, on the other hand, at the original Eli Lilly case involving University of California, not involving Ariad, the DNA encoding for human insulin, is that functional because that tells you what the DNA does? Or is that structural, because that really is a quite specific sequence of nucleotide bases. So, again, the question of structure or function sometimes comes up, and in certain circumstances, it's a maybe a shorthand way to look at one of these claims. But ultimately, I don't think it's a very satisfying way to really address the problems that are faced when one asks what's the appropriate scope of a claim, especially in the life sciences area, that someone should be entitled to.
Some of the examples in the Ariad patent merely described how the compounds of the invention could work by using interfering molecules or decoy molecules, but they never gave any examples of specific molecules in the patent. In your paper, you quote the court as saying this was, quote, not so much an example as it is a mere mention of a desired outcome, end quote. Could you explain what the court was referring to there?
What I think the court was getting at is perhaps pulling in a relatively old doctrine of U.S. patent law, which talks about restating the problem as the claim, as the invention. So there are some Supreme Court cases from the early decades of the 20th century, for example, that talk about the evils of using, quote, conveniently functional, close quote, claim language at the exact point of novelty. And It calls to mind your question a moment ago about a cure for baldness. Anyone who is able to identify a disease or a condition could, without doing any work at all, write a claim for a compound that cures that. If you have a good knowledge of the biochemical pathways behind some sort of disease, and perhaps you've even done Nobel-quality research concerning it, which is what some people would say with respect to the invention that's being litigated in this case. You can provide a lot of scientific information about what is going on in the body and about how you might be able to interfere with that disease mechanism by regulating a certain biochemical pathway. But if you've not actually made and tested or at least modeled specific compounds that do the job, you would not be able to write good claims to compounds or classes of compounds that actually do it. And so I'm always loath to try to get inside the head of a court or a judge, but I think perhaps the court's reference that you quoted in terms of the mention of a desired outcome calls to mind that doctrine of U.S. patent law, which says you cannot take a problem and restate it as a solution and get a patent on it.
And I suppose there's a difference between trying to claim a desired outcome on the one hand versus, as the example you gave, is interfering with a pathway that thereby interrupts the pathway, which then prevents the end product from being made, which would strike me as a more, what, application of knowledge to a useful purpose, which I guess is what patents are supposed to be about.
Right. Well, you certainly have to have done a lot of scientific work, and in fact, maybe even some really spectacular scientific work in order to be able to write a claim like that. But the cynic would say, or the person who thinks as a matter of policy that claims in the pharmaceutical or biotech area need to be or ought to be limited to specific compounds or families of compounds that are fully elaborated in the claim, that a person would say you've not gone far enough down the road. You have done the investigation. You have identified the problem, but all you have done is you have hypothesized the solution. You haven't taken the next step and actually solved the problem. And since you have not solved the problem, you should not be able to get a patent claim that will cut off and dominate solutions to the problem that are identified by other people.
Now, I won't ask you, given the constitution of the court, what's the outcome going to be based on either comments made by these judges in the past, but I understand in the concurring opinion filed with the April decision, Judge Lynn made some particular comments about the test as it currently stands. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There was a concurring opinion in the panel decision of the Ariad case, which was decided by three judges, as almost all appeals are, as a matter of routine at the Federal Circuit, where the concurring judge agreed that under existing Federal Circuit precedent, the claims were invalid and the judgment needed to be reversed, but expressed his view, as had been stated in previous concurring or dissenting opinions, that that precedent was not correct and needed to be reexamined. And, you know, as I said earlier in response to your first question, the fact that the court is taking this case en banc would indicate to me that there's a majority of judges who, in combination, either feel that the existing precedent is wrong and needs to be changed, or feel that the existing precedent is sufficiently unclear and is causing enough uncertainty among the industry and among the bar and among the district courts that it's time to try to address definitively what the standard is and clarify it and end the controversy until it comes up again.
Well, it can only be interesting. We'll have to wait and see.
It should be an interesting decision when it comes out.
Thank you very much for these insights, Charles.
Thank you, Don. It's always interesting to talk about these issues.
My guests for this podcast have been Krista Schwartz of Jones Day in Chicago and Charles Weiss of Kenyon & Kenyon in New York City. For further information on Krista Schwartz's paper entitled Software and Senza Fair, A Modest Proposal for Application of the Doctrine in Computer Software Cases. For further information on Charles Weiss's paper entitled Federal Circuit to Consider Existence of Written Description Requirement. And for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.